PRI, Public Radio International.
This lush rainforest in Peru's Amazon jungle grows so densely as to hide many of its natural wonders and riches. The vast tropical vegetation yields a cornucopia of edible plants, timber, firewood, and botanical medicines, some long used by native populations. About 80,000 different species of plants grow here. Nobody knows for sure how many, and only a small fraction have been scientifically studied. Medical botanists believe that in the thick jungle growth, nature may have camouflaged powerful cures for human diseases. In this program, you'll learn about the truly fascinating history of herbal remedies and how they're used today to treat ailments from the common cold to serious medical conditions. Welcome back to The Medicine Garden. I'm David Freudberg.
My interest in herbal medicine really started at the time I was a family doctor in a small rural town in California.
Physician David Katz, now in Sacramento, California.
I did everything from delivering babies to taking care of people in their later years and when they were dying. The thing that I noticed was that many people wouldn't take the standard medical treatments, so even though I knew that I could get rid of the symptoms that they were coming for, they weren't willing to do the treatment that I wanted because of the side effects that they got. Another group of people didn't get better from the standard treatments. For instance, if we looked at allergies, they took all the antihistamines that I had to offer them, either couldn't tolerate them or didn't get better, even went to the allergist, may have tried allergy shots, and that didn't make them better either. So they were back and they were asking for something else. So I began to look at what other types of treatments were available.
Dr. Katz decided to explore herbal medicines because they are natural and often are more gentle on the body than highly concentrated pharmaceutical drugs. An example is a plant-based remedy used with patients suffering from prostate problems.
There is a treatment that actually one of my colleagues at work introduced me to with sawgrass, which is an herb, which does help urine to flow more freely and helps the prostate to not interfere with urine flow during the night so that the person can truly empty their bladder and not have to get up over and over again. I don't believe medical science really understands exactly how it works, but for many men, it does work.
Sawgrass, often called saw palmetto, is an increasingly popular plant remedy. Public interest in herbal medicine is surging. Natural botanicals recently became the fastest-growing sector of the American pharmacy industry. In drugstores like this one outside Boston, medicinal plants are now widely available in powdered form and in extracts prepared as liquid tinctures, tablets, teas, cough drops, and ointments. Natural remedies like garlic, echinacea, ginseng, and dozens of other herbs are now commonly sold. Dr. Varro Tyler in West Lafayette, Indiana, was longtime dean of the pharmacy school at Purdue University.
It has become mainstream. It's very popular. People want to know about it. And it is really going to, I think, increase even more.
Why is it increasing?
Modern medicine is to some extent distrusted. It's high cost, difficulty of access, the fact that it can't cure everything. Neither can herbs, of course. But all of those things account for some distrust of modern medicine, so people want to try something else. In addition, herbal products are usually milder, both in their effects and in their side effects, and people like that in comparison to synthetic chemical agents.
Another strong appeal of herbal remedies is their low cost. Affordability may bring botanical medicine into greater future acceptance.
One of the big facts about healthcare in the late 20th century, is that it is phenomenally expensive. And one of the most expensive parts of any healthcare budget nationally or for a hospital or for a community is the drug bill. It is huge. And one of the obvious answers is herbs.
Health writer Barbara Griggs in London.
The cost to the hospital or the patient that uses them is going to be much, much lower than a drug because millions and millions and millions haven't been spent on developing them. I mean, herbs are there for everyone to use. Garlic, for instance, is an extremely good example. There are plenty of drugs on the market now that are prescribed for high blood pressure, and few of them are as effective, and none of them has fewer side effects than garlic. So garlic would be a very, very cheap medicine.
Food medicines like garlic are generally recognized as safe. And while some plants found in nature definitely are poisonous, properly prepared herbal medicines, if taken according to the recommended dose, are usually as safe as, if not safer than, pharmaceutical drugs. Professor Varro Tyler of Purdue.
The agencies that collect data from the poison control centers regarding poisoning by all kinds of products ranging from household cleansers to medicines put poisoning by plants in the absolute last category in terms of frequency. And that would include the reported frequency of poisoning by herbal remedies. It is extremely infrequent in the United States.
If herbs are relatively harmless and relatively cheap, where exactly do they fit into the repertoire of medical choices available to us? Physician Andrew Weil in Tucson, Arizona, is best-selling author of Spontaneous Healing.
I would like to see informed healthcare consumers who know when and when not to use standard medicine. In general, you use standard medicine for crises, you know, for things that are really severe. The problem is if you go to standard medicine with everything, with all the common complaints, I think you're likely to be treated with, especially with drugs, that can be toxic, expensive, and you fail to get the benefit of simpler remedies that most doctors simply are not trained in. You know, there's a lot of conditions out there for which there are simple, inexpensive remedies, many of them herbal, that could be tried before you use the strong, expensive stuff.
Dr. Weil says plant-based medicines can be helpful for certain moderate ailments, such as the common cold, allergies, skin conditions, and gastrointestinal disorders, as well as for some chronic maladies, like arthritis and cardiovascular conditions, where the patient wishes to avoid a prolonged regimen of synthetic drugs with unpleasant side effects. Plants, as nature designed them, often contain lower doses of medicine than do pharmaceuticals. And so, while herbs are frequently easier on your system, satisfactory results may take a little longer with botanicals.
The great attraction of herbal medicine is it is potentially everybody's.
Medical herbalist Simon Mills at the University of Exeter in England.
You can step outside any front door of any building in the world and you'll find three or four herbal remedies immediately accessible to you. Most of our grandparents had this ability. There was a basic understanding of plants in the past, which we unfortunately have lost.
The exact origins of herbal medicine will perhaps always remain as mysterious as nature itself. It is said that an ancient king suffering from leprosy retreated to the forest with his servant for a period of meditation and healing. There, holy flour descended from heaven, which when baked into a bread and eaten gave special powers. After consuming the bread, the servant became aware that the plants and trees around him began to speak, each announcing its own special medicinal property. Using this knowledge, the king was cured. Thus, according to legend, was the knowledge of plant medicine revealed to humanity.
I don't think any primitive tribe has ever been studied which didn't use the herbs around it for medicine. It is the oldest medicine of mankind.
Artifacts from antiquity found in present-day Iraq suggest that plants were used for their healing properties as long as 60,000 years ago. From 5,000 years ago, we have detailed written records of Chinese remedies using roots, barks, leaves, flowers, fruits, and seeds. The patient would brew up these ingredients into an herbal tea, or perhaps crush the plants and apply them topically. Many of these herbal cures came to the West by way of the Middle East. Historian Barbara Griggs is author of Green Pharmacy.
Rhubarb was one of the medicines, a great purgative and laxative, was introduced to the West from the Arabs. They also used a lot of the spices that they in turn borrowed from the Far East. So things like ginger and cinnamon, which have quite powerful medicinal uses, came to us through the Arabs as well.
The ancient Roman armies, as they campaigned throughout Europe, brought with them knowledge of plant-derived drugs. The influential second-century physician Galen blended herbs into complex mixtures, such as a legendary concoction known as theriac. His medical authority, as well as the custom of producing theriac, would endure for some 1,500 years.
Theriac was made with literally hundreds of herbs, some of which had to be picked in their prime, imported from Crete. Others had to be prepared in a special way. And just making theriac was actually a ceremony in Venice, which people went to see, rather as we might go to a rock concert. It was a great entertainment. The manufacture of this extraordinarily powerful and complex medicine, which was supposed to be able to save a man from the plague if necessary.
Throughout Europe in the Middle Ages, monasteries would cultivate herb gardens as the source of medicines dispensed by religious communities to the infirm. Literate monks followed instructions printed in herbals, the name for prescription books that listed healing plants and their uses. The books often sounded a spiritual note.
There's always an acknowledgement that herbs are a gift of God, that they're part of a creation of which we are also part. It was a very holistic view. There's a sense that we're all involved. There's a macrocosm of which we are a part, and that stars, herbs, trees, fishes, all sorts of creatures, and ourselves, all designed to work together.
In olden times, when knowledgeable physicians were few and far between, botanical remedies that could be harvested in your backyard offered an accessible form of health care. But folk medicine could be inaccurate and sometimes vulnerable to outrageous quackery. That's how it appeared to the emerging class of university-trained doctors, all of them male, beginning in the 16th century. They dismissed many home-based herbal practices as old wives' tales.
Clearly, there were many things done in the ancient world that were superstitious and had no scientific basis, but there were also some things done there that were very sensible.
Physician Andrew Weil.
There was a condition called dropsy, which was the accumulation of fluid in the lower extremities. We now call it edema. This was very common, and the major reason for it is heart failure. And conventional medicine had no treatment for it. But there were these wise women, or old wives in the countryside, who were able to treat dropsy. They gave them herbal teas, and the chief constituent of it was foxglove leaf. And finally, a young English physician was persuaded by his fiancée to visit one of these women in Shropshire who had a great reputation for curing dropsy. And he realized something interesting was going on there and got her tea and realized that the thing in it that was probably doing it was foxglove. And he wrote a paper called An Account of the Foxglove and Its Medicinal Uses that made him the most famous physician in Europe and brought this plant into medicine.
To get a feel for the historical use of botanical medicine, I took a tour of the Queen's Herb Garden outside London.
It is the kind of day one often associates with England, little drizzly, little gray, little raw. but it's cheered by a pleasant companion, Laura Ponsonby, here at the Royal Botanic Gardens, often known as Kew Gardens, the world's largest botanic garden collection.
Right, well, we've just arrived at this little Queen's Garden, which is behind a house which is known as the Dutch House, or Kew Palace. Once upon a time, King George III lived there, and it was, in fact, his mother who founded Kew Gardens in the 18th century. In front of us, we have a lovely bed of culinary herbs, and then in the main Nosegay Garden, which is a sunken garden, we've got lots of medicinal plants.
Can you show us a few examples?
Yes, of course. We'll just walk over here, shall we? Now, this is an interesting one. It's called comfrey, and the Latin name is symphytum. But here, we might think about the old English name, which is setbone or knitbone. And this was used for sprains and breaks. So it was very good for healing limbs and so on. And it was the root which was used. They smashed it up and made it like a sort of plaster and then put it round whatever part needed to be helped.
A poultice.
A poultice, yes. And interestingly, today we do know that the plant contains something called allantoin, which has a power of healing tissue. So it's a good example of one which was used in the past, given a name because of its use, and today it's not just what they call an old wives' tale. There does seem to be quite a lot of truth in using comfrey. Another one familiar, I think, to many people, is the rosemary. Rosemary, which has got just a long line. This one's got a few yellow leaves as well.
This is the common culinary spice, rosemary.
That's right, exactly. And it's got just a few little mauve flowers showing as well. That originally came from the Mediterranean. And the name rosemary, rosmarinus, meant it was the dew of the sea, because very often that's where it really liked to grow, was near the seaside, so rosmarinus. And this one we use today, of course, as a culinary herb. But it was very valued for troubles of the brain, and it was said to improve the memory. And so in Shakespeare, there is a quotation, isn't there? Rosemary, that's for remembrance. And some people have suggested that it wasn't just a sentimental remembrance, but perhaps it was in fact referring to the brain. And apparently in olden days, when people were doing tests or exams, they used to wear either a little chaplet of rosemary or a rosemary sprig behind the ear, and this improved the brain.
Would that it were so easy.
Would that it were so easy, indeed. Now, another one which actually did work was willow. They said because willow grew in a wet place that it would be good for your rheumatics. You know, your rheumatics always bad when it's a sort of cold and damp. And they actually found in the bark of willow salicylic acid, which, of course, is later synthesised with aspirin. So there was some truth in it. But so many plants in small amounts are beneficial to us. We'll probably see a foxglove a little bit later on. I mean, that's a very good example I often use to people. Very poisonous if you tried to settle down to a dinner of foxglove leaves instead of a green veg. That would be it. And even Agatha Christie's used it in some of her stories. But foxglove, of course, is used in heart troubles.
And we'll be able to take a look at foxglove in a moment?
Yes, we will indeed. Yes, now, this is amusing. Just along here, we've got a bench which has got chamomile on it. It's not very much at the moment, but in the 17th century, and obviously earlier, life was not a very sweet one, and everybody smelt terribly because they didn't wash and so on. And so when you came with your friends and wanted to perhaps have some nice conversation on a nice day in the garden, really the best place was to sit on your chamomile seat. You bruised it and up round you came this lovely smell. And of course in England they used to have chamomile lawns. If you go to Buckingham Palace and stroll about on the Queen's lawns at the back, you'll find that some of her lawn is not grass, but it is of chamomile. So that was an early lawn, very often used.
Now this is the same herb from which chamomile tea is made.
That's exactly right. The flowers of chamomile are used for making the tea. And the other thing about interesting thing about chamomile is that one of its names was the plant's physician, or the plant's doctor. And it was said that if you had a sickly plant in the garden, if you grew it near the chamomile had a wonderful beneficial effect on it, and it perked up and did very well. So who knows, perhaps it might help. Well, we're just walking along, and I do see, in fact, we have got foxglove just near us. We've got one of the white forms just next to us, and there's the typical purple one. Very often you find when it's out, you'll find a bee inside. Fox's Glue is one of its names, but that is a lifesaver, really.
On the other side of the Atlantic, Europeans were discovering a new world where natives had long refined the natural art of healing with herbs. At the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Science, America's oldest pharmacy school, Professor Ara Demartirosyan has studied the history of botanical medicine in North America.
The American Indian up in Maine, Penobscot, for example, taught the settlers there how to use the mayapple root extract on skin cancers. It does actually work in topical skin cancers. And here the American Indians were using this product. They taught us about the use of pine needles as a source of vitamin C. You know, we didn't know that. We didn't have the citrus fruits. So they were not getting suffering from scurvy, whereas the settlers were, because they wouldn't drink the pine needle tea, for example. It was considered too foreign. But then after a while, they began to realize we better pay attention to what they're eating because they're healthy.
One of the things that impressed the settlers about the Indians when they first met them was what a splendid-looking people they were. I mean, it was very impressive to the settlers that they saw very few Indians who squinted or were hunched-backed or who limped or were deformed. I mean, mostly they seemed to be very well-made people, very strong, with natural good health and fitness and sort of an athletic build. And the Indians had a very wide knowledge of the herbs and roots that grew around them. There was blue flag, for instance, which was used by the Creek Indians as a cathartic, as a very, very powerful purge. The Albany Indians used it topically to apply to leg ulcers to make a poultice. Another plant which was very interesting to the settlers was a plant called boneset, which quite a lot of tribes use to help them break a fever. And in fact, boneset produces quite a powerful sweat.
Many plant medicines learned from the Native Americans remain widely used to this day, including echinacea, a popular natural remedy for colds. Even with the rise of chemical drugs that accelerated in the 1800s, botanical cures were common pharmacy items into the first part of the 20th century. Pharmacy professor Ara Demartirosyan.
My grandfather was a pharmacist. Based on that background, I grew up in a pharmacy, and during the 40s, 50s, or 60s, in an old-time pharmacy, which was still making a lot of its preparations directly from scratch. And we had 1,000 drawers full of every known drug there was, the powdered materials, leaf material, standardized herbs, which were sold as teas. So I had that kind of background. And my grandfather, because he spoke about 3 or 4 languages, was able to handle a lot of questions of all the people of the Middle East who spoke either Armenian or Arabic or Turkish or Greek, and they were asking for a lot of these old-time remedies.
Indeed, herbal medicine remains the dominant form of health care throughout the globe. The UN's World Health Organization estimates that today 80% of the Earth's population receives care through traditional medicine, of which plant remedies are a mainstay. The U.S. is unusual in its heavy reliance on pharmaceuticals, which often emphasize one potent synthesized drug, rather than the blend of gentler natural ingredients found in plants. Purdue University pharmacy professor Varro Tyler.
Probably the United States is the single country in the world that has concentrated most on this single chemical entity magic bullet approach in comparison to almost all other countries. And that includes industrially advanced nations such as England, France, Germany, Canada. I think that this came about probably because of the patent situation, the financial, the economic side of things that came along in the 1930s and perhaps early 1940s, but more in the 30s. And did away with a lot of these older remedies that had been used for long periods of time. They were not necessarily ineffective, but none of them could be patented. And therefore, if they could be replaced with a single chemical entity that was a novel chemical compound and could be patented, then obviously the manufacturer was going to market that product, was going to advertise that product to physicians, because you can charge more for it, you can get a greater return for your stockholders. The largest botanical drug company in the United States, S.B. Pinnick, in its declining years in the 1950s, was headed by a man named S. Barksdale Pinnick. And I remember vividly a conversation I had with him in New York one time, where his company was located, in which he lamented the fact that these products could not be patented. And he said his business was going downhill. Consequently, his firm was sold and, of course, now is no more.
As botanical medicines disappeared from the shelves of drugstores, patients who didn't grow their own turned to health food shops as the supplier of healing herbs. And pharmacy schools, which at one time provided broad education in botanical medicine, began eliminating herbal courses from the curriculum. Thus, a new generation of neighborhood druggists in America had little knowledge of plant remedies, contrasting the picture in many European countries.
I was in Germany a couple of years ago, and one thing that I noticed, I was in Bavaria. All of the pharmacies that I saw had window displays that were 100% natural products.
Physician Andrew Weil.
Everything in the windows was natural products. It was valerian for sleep, peppermint oil for irritable bowel syndrome, ginkgo biloba for improved blood circulation. I mean, all the products were that. And when you walked into these pharmacies, one of the first things that you saw was a big revolving rack of herbal teas. And the pharmacist would tell you what the teas were for and how to use them. You know, this is all true not only in Germany, it's true in France, it's true to some extent in Italy, certainly Switzerland, Austria. You know, this is a worldwide movement. We are being left in the dust by other countries.
But in the United States, the tide has begun to turn. Herbal medicines are now resurfacing in many American pharmacies as over-the-counter remedies. Yet while at least a third of Americans are trying alternative healthcare techniques, including herbs, most do not tell their doctors, according to a survey in the New England Journal of Medicine. Patients apparently perceive that the medical profession frowns on natural therapies.
I think medicine and botany have moved very, very far apart.
Andrew Weil in Tucson, Arizona, is both a physician and a botanist.
You know, at one time these were fields that were very closely allied, and today it's almost impossible to find people that speak the same language. Now, why this upsets me, I mean, not only does it make me an endangered species, but it seems to me it's a measure of the distance that has grown up between medicine and nature, and science and nature in general. And I find that very scary, because it seems to me that fundamentally healing is a natural process. A lot of my writing and work has been to try to direct people's attention to the innate nature of healing, the fact that the body heals itself and has that potential, and I think good medicine should build on that foundation. But there is a real sense in medicine today and in our society that nature is somehow the enemy, that we have to control it, distance ourselves from it, and that leads us to think that when there's something wrong with us, we need outside intervention. And that's, I think, a reason that we have the kind of healthcare crisis that we do today, why we produce all the adverse reactions we do, why, you know, for many kinds of diseases, the kinds of treatments we have are so destructive and invasive and so reliant on technology. I think that's a big issue.
You're listening to The Medicine Garden. I'm David Freudberg.
In our next half hour, which botanical remedies actually work, and a look at the herbal medicine traditions of China and India. If you'd like to order a copy of The Medicine Garden on audio cassette tape to review the information on herbal remedies, please call toll-free 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Thank you. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
It's tea time here in the Medicine Garden. I'm David Freudberg, And today I'm steeping a cup of herbal tea. This is chamomile, often consumed as a mild relaxant to ease our passage through this harried world. Common herbal beverages are likely to have only minor health benefits, if any. But certain plants, when brewed up into a tea or extracted into a liquid tincture or tablet, are used for serious medical conditions. Some patients rely on herbs to treat ailments ranging from arthritis to high blood pressure to menopausal symptoms. These botanical remedies are growing in popularity because they can be less harsh on the body and in many cases cost less than high-tech chemical medicine. But today in the U.S., most physicians receive little or no training in herbal cures.
When I was in medical school, it was ridiculed. Doctors and teachers and my fellow medical students and myself felt that people were just fooling themselves. There was a placebo effect that would explain any improvement, or perhaps it was just chance. And yet the public continued to use herbs and other alternative therapies.
Depending on your perspective, either a large sector of the public is simply wasting its time and money on worthless treatments, or most doctors are blindly ignoring evidence that natural therapies can be effective. The question seems to turn on how you prove whether a healthcare technique like herbal medicine is genuinely useful. Just because a practice is fashionable does not make it convincing to physicians like Robert Temple, who evaluates drugs for the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA.
That doesn't impress me one way or the other. Before conventional medicine learned how to study things properly, they believed in the wildest collection of interventions that one could imagine, leeches and bleeding and so on. And although those were widely perceived as effective and were very popular, none of them worked. And now we know that.
Throughout history, herbal medicine has offered a kind of refuge for patients steering clear of especially brutal treatments administered by conventional doctors. Gentle botanical remedies provided an alternative to such standard medical practices as blistering and prescribing toxic doses of mercury. Some modern-day patients turn to herbs, hoping to escape the irritating side effects sometimes produced by pharmaceutical drugs. Dr. David Katz.
At least I can tell you what I have experienced in my own practice is that there are people who I have tried medical treatments which are standard pharmaceuticals, and they have not tolerated any of them for instance, high blood pressure, for chronic fatigue, for sleep problems, and for allergies like hay fever. And they have gotten better on herbal preparations, whereas they could not tolerate the standard treatments.
Mainstream medical science does not accept such experiences as conclusive evidence that herbal medicine works. Only clinical experiments that rule out any possible coincidences will satisfy the strict medical standards. In the case of herbs, these clinical trials generally have not been performed because they're so expensive. According to a government report, the average pharmaceutical drug now costs $238 million to develop and test. Drug companies cannot patent a naturally occurring plant, and so have little incentive to invest in costly tests for herbal remedies. Thus, according to FDA physician Robert Temple, the effectiveness of herbs has not been proven.
You can't say whether a therapy is useful or not unless you've done the studies that show that it is. And so when a physician chooses either a conventional medicine or an alternative type of medicine, he has to have some idea based on good studies of whether it works, or he can't possibly make the choice rationally. I should add one thing. I realize that many of the people who use these therapies believe in them, even though they haven't had the kinds of trials that I'm saying are necessary. It's important to appreciate that these kinds of observations aren't necessarily wrong. Much of medicine starts with a careful, uncontrolled observation, an anecdote, if you like. It's that they don't constitute credible evidence. They might be right, they might be wrong, but you can't tell.
That view is unrealistically rigid in the minds of healthcare providers who practice herbal medicine. They believe if millions of people say botanical treatment works for them, that experience has some validity. Physician Andrew Weil.
I have gotten many people off of pharmaceutical antihistamines and onto stinging nettles with very good results. This is a plant that has no toxicity, no side effects, and really works. It ends symptoms like itchy eyes and sneezing and all the kind of stuff that goes along with hay fever.
Why would it be preferable for a patient accustomed, say, to antihistamine over-the-counter medications that anybody could buy in a pharmacy to turn to this plant called stinging nettle?
Because antihistamines have awful side effects. They make you groggy, they interfere with mood, they interfere with sleep, they contribute to depression. But, you know, there's a good placebo-controlled, randomized, double-blind study demonstrating the efficacy of stinging nettles. And I find that, you know, most doctors, not only have they never heard of stinging nettles, but it's beyond their conception that there could be such a test that's in the literature, but there it is.
Dr. Weil feels that because herbal therapy is generally not taught in medical school, it remains a foreign subject to most doctors. But there's another factor at work, according to historian and author Barbara Griggs in London.
The trouble with herbal medicine has always been that it's been a very good medicine for amateurs. So what do the doctors do? I mean, doctors are not keen on people doctoring themselves. I mean, this is as true today as it was 1,000 or 10,000 years ago. So doctors throughout the ages, especially in the last 2,000 years, have always been at pains to distance themselves and to distance medicine from this simple common practice of you go out into your back garden and pick a leaf of this or a bloom of that and brew it up and it'll help your cough or your hangover or your indigestion or whatever it is.
Regardless of motive, today's medical establishment, including the powerful American Medical Association, or AMA, is often at odds with the huge wave of public interest in alternative health care. According to Professor Varro Tyler, former dean of the pharmacy school at Purdue University, doubtful doctors are simply ill-informed about herbs.
There is a good deal of confusion among persons who are not specialists in the field about nomenclature, for example, in the herbal field. A common plant, such as chamomile, has 10 different scientific names. And to revert to one of the AMA's recent errors, apparently the people involved did not know the difference between ginseng and Siberian ginseng. They're totally different. And yet the AMA failed to recognize that these two plants were different, and the authors who were physicians of the paper that was published didn't recognize that they were different. And so you have a rather serious error in accusing ginseng that might have been due to something from Siberian ginseng. And that's the kind of thing where more knowledge is required than those people possess, unfortunately.
Against this confusing backdrop, it's perhaps not surprising that herbal medicine in the United States finds itself in the awkward position of what's been called a regulatory twilight zone. Current federal law guarantees public access to certain non-prescription health products, including vitamins and herbs. Although herbs obviously are consumed as medicine, technically they're not classified as drugs under the law. Thus, producers of these products are prohibited from making any health claims on the packaging to indicate, for example, that echinacea is used for cold symptoms. Professor Tyler.
If you look at the legislation, from 1906, from 1938, from 1962, the intent of Congress was to grandfather all of these herbal remedies to permit them to be sold as drugs, even without the modern proof of efficacy that came in after 1962. However, the Food and Drug Administration, by a very clever application of administrative regulation, said, yes, these can be sold, but if you make any claim for them on the label, if you say they're good for anything or good to treat anything, then we will consider them as an unapproved drug and we will confiscate them.
To be federally approved as a drug, each herb would have to undergo the testing process that typically costs hundreds of millions of dollars. As a practical matter, this is simply prohibitive for botanical suppliers. Thus, the marketplace now is filled with products whose labeling reveals little and is almost certain to leave most consumers baffled.
Well, I hope we will continue to require proper studies before we grant claims.
FDA physician Robert Temple.
I would say that we now have complete availability, at least, of nutritional supplements, which includes all herbals, so long as they don't make claims, so that to the extent people in the community think they know what they're doing and think they know what they want, they have near complete access to them. And I like the idea that it's quite clear that if you want to make claims, you have some work to do, which I believe you should.
Let's take an example, an ancient sleep aid and minor tranquilizer, valerian.
Professor Tyler.
It's a mild tranquilizer and has less side effects than some of our synthetic drugs.
Is it addictive?
No, it's not addictive. And it's been used for this very purpose for at least 1,000 years. So you might say that valerian had been adequately tested by people just because of the millions and millions of doses that had been taken without any reporting of adverse side effects. Now, I want to emphasize immediately that our Food and Drug Administration will not accept that. They say that history doesn't count.
The dilemma of how to regulate herbs is faced by other nations as well. One possible model for resolving the dispute is found in Germany. Commission E, a panel of the German Federal Health Agency, has been evaluating plant medicine since 1978. Physicians, pharmacists, pharmacologists, and other commission members have methodically reviewed over 300 botanical remedies. Broad scientific studies, a pattern of historical use, and even individual cases reported by doctors are deemed relevant. To date, about 200 of these herbal remedies have been approved. Physician Andrew Weil.
I would love to see more research on some of these products, but the German Commission E has done an enormous amount of work to sort out those herbs that are likely to be useless and possibly dangerous from those that are likely to be safe and effective. And it's amassed a great deal of data on them and has also clearly indicated the need for future research.
It's an open question whether the United States will ever adopt a system along the lines of the German Commission E to determine which plants are effective remedies. But experts in botanical medicine insist that a great deal of scientific literature already exists on the healing properties of herbs. A computer database compiled in Chicago at the University of Illinois College of Pharmacy has amassed summaries of some 130,000 scientific articles on plants and their potential use as medicine. The information is collected with funding from the UN's World Health Organization. The project director, Professor Norman Farnsworth, believes that for some herbs, solid evidence does exist.
Those few plants, saw palmetto, which is used for benign prostatic hyperplasia.
It's enlarged prostate.
Right. There is nettle root. I won't bother you with scientific names. And you'll notice when I go through the list, all of these grow in the United States. There is feverfew, which if you take a fresh leaf even of feverfew and chew it up, if you have migraine, the migraine attack goes away or is greatly reduced in pain. Then you have garlic, which obviously is used for cardiovascular problems. It lowers cholesterol about 17%. Not dramatic, but it does it. It also inhibits platelet aggregation, which could prevent stroke. Ginkgo biloba, the oldest fossil tree on the planet. This is grown in South Carolina. There is a plantation with 10 million ginkgo trees, probably the largest stand of any plant ever in the history of the world. And they don't come out and say this is used for Alzheimer's disease, but what they're saying is it improves retention, loss of memory. So those are about the ones where we know from clinical studies and animal studies and in vitro studies, we know the mechanism of action, we know the chemical constituents, and we know whenever there are side effects, it's usually of an allergenic nature. And if you stop taking it, the allergy goes away.
Dr. Farnsworth adds that there are many other herbs which may have genuine medicinal effects, but which have not yet been subjected to the same degree of scientific testing. In this category, he places ginseng, the small perennial plant widely taken in Chinese medicine for its purported revitalizing qualities and host of other uses. Chinese medicine is the oldest known system of botanical healing. Today, the official roster of Chinese remedies, known as the pharmacopoeia, lists some 700 plants, each identified with its specific curative properties. The use of Chinese medicinal herbs made the difference between illness and health for Andrew Gedert in Oakland, California.
I had Crohn's disease, which is a gastrointestinal disorder, and that was untreated by Western medicine. I'd also tried various other nutritional methods, and nothing had helped me. So I sought the help of Chinese herbs, and gradually I felt my digestion began to improve. I was having significantly less pain. I was no longer had to be hospitalized, and so I became a real true believer.
Gedert embarked on a serious study of Chinese herbal healing and now conducts a clinic in Oakland, California, in association with Dr. Feng Feng, a formerly trained physician and author who was born in China. According to Dr. Feng, disease results from an imbalance of yin and yang, the two basic life energies said to be present in bodily organs.
How can you determine the degree of imbalance of my yin and yang?
Oh, because I check your pulse and see that. From your pulse and see how your five organs working.
Which organs are those?
The heart, the lungs, the stomach, and the liver, and your kidney. These five organs must be work together peacefully, and you feel better.
Depending on his diagnosis, Dr. Feng could prescribe several herbal remedies, some containing ingredients familiar to Westerners, like cinnamon or chrysanthemum, and some with descriptive names like cramp bark, prescribed for menstrual pain. The herbs are usually brewed up into a tea or infusion, which the patient drinks. Physician Andrew Weil in Tucson.
Chinese herbal medicine in practice differs from Western herbal medicine in that instead of prescribing single remedies, they always prescribe combinations of remedies, and usually never fewer than 12 plants in one prescription. Some of the plants are there because they're considered as adjuvants of other herbs. Licorice, for example, is present in almost in many, many Chinese herbal formulas. For one thing, it's got a sweet taste that disguises the taste of some of the more bitter constituents. But also, licorice is widely considered to be something that increases the effect of other herbal medicines.
Chinese herbal philosophy strongly emphasizes the concept of synergy. In other words, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Healing properties are generally attributed to the interaction of plants in a mixture and not individual herbs. In recent years, Chinese researchers have begun applying modern scientific tests to the ancient herbal formulas.
And in a remarkable number of cases, there has been verification of the effects attributed to these plants in the traditional system. You know, not in all cases. I'm sure there's some plants there that are worthless or that are there just for superstitious reasons. But there have been some that have been tested that really work. You know, classic example is ephedra, which is the oldest medicinal plant of which we have written records. There are records from several thousand years ago documenting the use of this plant, recommending it for asthma and chest congestion. And it's now, as I said, the source of a Western drug, ephedrine, that we use for treating asthma. So there's likely to be a lot in the Chinese herbal pharmacopoeia that will pan out by modern testing methods.
This intriguing intersection of Western science and ancient Eastern knowledge is likely to produce a kind of synergy of its own.
And I think that's really the great future in herbal medicine, is to work hand in hand with Western medical treatment.
Do you think there are certain kinds of conditions which are more effectively treated by herbal medicine?
In terms of gynecological complaints, immune disorders, and digestive disorders, Chinese medicine and herbal medicine have a great deal to offer in more maintenance situations. In other words, if somebody is vomiting up blood and they have tremendous abdominal cramps, they may need to go to the emergency room. But eventually, when they are not hospitalized, the herbs can have a great deal of impact so that they don't have to take so many Western medicines. In terms of gynecological complaints, we get very, very good results with women with PMS, hot flashes during menopause, menstrual cramps. We get, you know, tremendous results.
In addition to drinking herbal teas for medicine, some medicinal plants are eaten as foods and spices. This practice was taught to Martin Yan, who grew up in Guangzhou, China. He's now an internationally acclaimed chef based in San Francisco and host of the PBS television series Yan Can Cook.
Most traditional house Chinese household, they practice herbal medicine as a religion. My mother always cooked something with herbs. And the Chinese believe in preventive holistic healings. They believe in preventive medicines.
Yan continues to use herbs in his own renowned cuisine, not just for flavor, but for medicine.
When I make soups, I will do a lot of ginger. Ginger is a very healthy food itself, help digestion, help a lot of things. And I use tangerine peels, and I use occasionally use ginseng. And I also use a lot of type of Chinese herbs to help digestions. So in my pantry, I actually have a variety of herbs.
That some herbs lead a double life, both as culinary flavorings and as useful medicines, is nowhere more delectably evident than in the cuisine of India and its island neighbor Sri Lanka. Most of the spices blended into a dish of curry promote smooth digestion of the foods they season. The garlic can help ward off a cold, and hot peppers, either in mild or incendiary doses, can promote good circulation and ease conditions of the lungs and sinus. In fact, a well-spiced meal can be powerful preventive medicine. To learn about the art of healthy Eastern eating, I spent time in the kitchen with Dr. K. Ganeshan, a gifted chef who happens to be a medical doctor from Sri Lanka, educated at England's Royal College of Surgeons and now living in the United States.
Yeah. We're chopping up some cabbage, chopping it rather fine chopping, quickens the cooking process.
So we're going to have sort of a curry tonight of cabbage and carrots with onions and chilies and other spices.
Yes. Cabbage by itself, sometimes cabbage can be cooked with just salt and a little turmeric, and it's very tasty.
Turmeric is that bright yellow spice.
Turmeric is a bright yellow spice. It's one of the best antiseptics for the intestinal system. In fact, turmeric is used on the outside for as a poultice for starting abscesses.
At the stove, Dr. Ganeshan began by sautéing these onions along with mild chili peppers and the flavorful seed spices, fenugreek, cumin, and black mustard. As a sumptuous aroma rose up from the pan, he added the thinly chopped cabbage along with carrots.
Cabbage has its own water, so to start with, it can cook by itself. Then we keep checking to make sure it's not sticking at the bottom. And if it begins to do that, then we add a little extra water. Once the cabbage begins to cook, then it's time to add the powdered spices.
Hardest part of the job is opening the bottle of the powdered spices.
And for this curry, we're going to add powdered cayenne, which is the red one, the hot one.
Don't want to add too much of that cayenne because it's pretty powerful stuff.
It is. Cumin powder.
Ground cumin powder.
Ground cumin. About half a teaspoon. And coriander. Coriander is... We can add more of coriander.
That's sort of a heaping teaspoon.
Teaspoon. Coriander very soft in the stomach, so it aids the digestion. Now we're adding turmeric, which is a bright yellow powder, but too much of it can be bitter. So the usual proportion is if we add 1 teaspoon of cayenne, we would add 1/2 to 1 of cumin, little more than 1 of coriander, and only about 1/4 of turmeric. A little bit of ginger powder is good. It aids the digestion. And garlic.
Of course, garlic could be minced whole, or it's available in a powdered form.
That's right. Now, garlic, when it's minced whole, it's best added along with the onions and fried within the oil. That works well, and it's a great flavor when it's fried.
When you're first preparing the base for the vegetables that are later added.
That's correct, yeah. We're going to take a little oil to cook. The sizzling now is when the cabbage is losing its water.
What a grand design that nature should serve up valuable medicines in the foods and spices we so enjoy. And what a wondrous mystery that cures for human diseases lie undiscovered in the vast natural forest we call the medicine garden. I'm David Freudberg.
You've been listening to The Medicine Garden, written, produced, and narrated by David Freudberg. If you'd like to order a cassette tape of The Medicine Garden to review the information about herbal remedies, please call us at 1-800-5-LISTEN. We'll repeat that number in a moment. Associate producer for this program, Lisa Mullins. Mixing engineer, Steve Colby. Consultant, Mark Blumenthal. Music written and performed by Jim Richards, based on a theme by Antonin Dvorak. Special thanks to Tony Buck, Trina Tsuderos, Groton Baldwin, Catherine Karapetian, Jim Duke, Bob Carty, and to Harnett's Homeopathy and Body Care. This program is presented by Far Reaching Communications. Again, to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Thank you for listening. Funds for this Public Radio International program were made possible by the Herb Research Foundation, General Nutrition Centers, Nature's Way, and the Public Radio International Program Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.